A special speaker at a national conference in July of 2009 told an extraordinary situation that happened to him as a pastor. A lady in his church came to him on the invitation after a revival service and told him that she needed to talk to him about something very important. A little while later, he invited her into his office, closed the door, and they both sat down. He looked across the desk at her and said, "Kim," and that was the name that he made up for her, "Kim, how can I help you?" And she said, "Pastor, I need to tell you that I love you." The pastor smiled, replied, "Well, Kim, that's nice. We love you in the Lord too." She said, "No, Pastor, you don't understand. I'm in love with you, and I just needed to let you know." He said, "What did you say?" And again she said, "Pastor, I'm in love with you." He said, "Oh, you love me." "Yes, Pastor, I love you." Now would you look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. There are key passages in the Bible to which you would go to study some key Bible teaching. For instance, if you wanted to know about sacrificial, agape, unconditional love, you would go to 1 Corinthians chapter 13. If you want to understand the doctrine of the resurrected body, you would go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15. If you want to know about the offices of the church, you would go to 1 Timothy chapter 3 and others like that. And if you wanted to go to a passage that talks about what to do and what not to do in relation to getting to the marriage altar, it would clearly be 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Begin reading with me at verse 3. Notice it says, "For this is the will of God, even your sanctification, that ye should abstain from fornication, that every one of you should know how to possess his vessel." And it's the phrase refers to how to get a wife, how to acquire a wife, how to get a wife. And the word vessel there is the same word that's used in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7, referring to the weaker vessel. And he says how to possess his vessel in sanctification and honor. Sanctification means a holy way versus an unholy way. And honor means in a way that shows her value and her worth. Not, he says, in the lust of concupiscence. And the word concupiscence there means that it is possible to desire strongly something, that which is forbidden, and the lust just pulls you right toward that. Not in the lust of concupiscence. How? Even as the Gentiles which know not God. In other words, there are always going to be people who are violating God's commandments, doing things their own way, but he says you want to make sure you don't do it that way. Now, verse 6 is the key verse. That no man, it means no person, go beyond, it means transgress, overstep proper limits, and defraud, it means to cheat or take something wrongly, defraud his brother, the word brother there means a fellow believer, a brother or sister, either one, in any matter, because that the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also have forewarned you and testified. He said, we've already talked about that when we were with you. We have given testimonies how God does this. For God hath not called us unto uncleanness, but unto holiness. The word uncleanness, he says, if you don't do this the right way, he says, God has not called us to uncleanness. And the word means a super filthy way of life, morally speaking. Did you know there are folks who are living super filthy ways of life, morally speaking? And the first occurrence of the Greek word for that was in Matthew 23:27 and referred to the filthiness and the uncleanness inside a grave. So he said, God hath not called us unto this filthy uncleanness, but unto holiness. That is the way God wants us to live life. And then he winds up. It's interesting. It's almost like he says, you know, I think some people are not going to like this. I think some people are going to reject this. I think somebody's going to despise this. And so he says, therefore that despiseth not man. And the word despise there means to reject, to refuse, to cast off, to disregard. The same word is used in Mark chapter 7, verse 9, where Jesus said, full well ye reject the commandment of God that ye may keep your own tradition. So he says, there are going to be people who just disregard this, who reject this, who despise this. He therefore that despiseth not man. It's not he's despising the teacher or preacher or friend or parent who gives him this, but he despises God, who hath also given unto us His Holy Spirit. And the implication is that the Holy Spirit accompanies this truth from His Word wherever and whenever it is preached. Now, one of the most powerful verses to believers, I believe, in the entire Bible is that verse, 1 Thessalonians 4:6, that no man go beyond and defraud his brother in any matter, because that the Lord is the avenger of all such, as we also have forewarned you and testified. Would you notice, first of all, the meaning of that command? This is evidently a serious negative command given by God. So what does it mean when it says that no man go beyond and defraud his brother, it means, or sister, in any matter? The first occurrence of the word defraud in the Bible is in Leviticus 19:13. It says, thou shalt not defraud thy neighbor, neither rob him. To defraud is to cheat or rob somebody. The Hebrew word is also translated deceive, oppress, or deceitfully gotten. The English word defraud comes from the Latin de, meaning down, and fraudo, meaning to cheat. So to defraud is to bring someone down in defeat by cheating him. I heard about a building that collapsed. They started studying to find out why, and they found the contractor had not put the steel support rods in the concrete he was supposed to have put in there. The owner of that building was cheated by the man who built it. The builder had more money in his pocket because he used less steel, but now the building was gone, and the owner of the building had been defrauded. It is possible for a husband or wife to defraud his or her mate. The Bible teaches that a wife's body belongs to her husband and a husband's body belongs to his wife. And 1 Corinthians 7 verse 3 says, let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. And then verse 5 says, defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. Husbands and wives, we're not meant by God to live together like brothers and sisters. And one of them decides to do so, she or he robs and steals and cheats their mate. It is also possible to defraud by stirring up wrong desires. That no man or person go beyond and defraud his brother or sister in any matter. Now, the strange woman of Proverbs 6 and 7 used her words, her smooth words, her eyes, her immodest dress, her coy, cute ways, her flirtatious actions to try to stir up the simple young man. She is stirring up wrong desires that cannot be righteously fulfilled, and thereby she is defrauding him. I was in Denver, Colorado several years ago, and I had preached the message, Seeds of Disintegration, planted by the boyfriend-girlfriend philosophy. And a lady came up to me weeping and said, my 16-year-old brother committed suicide 5 years ago when a girl rejected him. Another man came up after I preached the message and said, I really need to get that message for the principal of our Christian school. We have a number of girls leaving to go to the public school, and the reason they say they're going is because they'll have a bigger selection of boys to choose from. Those girls were planning and trying to deliberately defraud, like the strange woman of Proverbs 6 and 7. But perhaps the primary way defrauding takes place is when a young man or man who is already married or who is not ready for marriage shows special attention to someone who is not his wife now or who will not be his wife or who is not ready to be married. Let me say that again. Perhaps the primary way defrauding takes place is when a young man or a man who is already married or who is not ready for marriage shows special attention to someone who is not his wife now or who will not be his wife or who is not ready to be married. Defrauding happens when you pay special attention to either the wrong person or you do so at the wrong time. Now, I've given the meaning of defrauding. Let me tell you, secondly, the magnitude of the sin of defrauding. This is what really launched this message, is I was studying this one day, and I was astounded at how big this sin was, and how we treat it like it's just a little puppy dog that you pet. And I'll show you here in a minute that God doesn't view it at all like a puppy dog. He views it like a terrible fire-breathing dragon. Now, what do I mean by magnitude? I mean that the sin of defrauding is far worse, with far more serious consequences than almost any other sin in the entire Bible. And I'll show you why I say that. Two reasons. First of all, this is the only negative command I know of in the Bible in relation to getting to the marriage altar. This is the negative command. If you're going to get a wife, don't do it this way. Now, the most serious consequences come not from breaking God's positive commands, but from breaking His negative commands. Adam was told that he could eat freely of every tree in the garden, but he should not eat of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. When Adam broke that negative command, he plunged the entire human race into sin. In 1 Kings chapter 13, when the unnamed man of God disobeyed God's negative command, a lion killed him and simply stood over him without devouring the carcass. Now, there is one that I have been able to find, one negative command directly to husbands in the entire Bible. It is powerful. In Colossians 3:19, Paul warned, "Be not bitter against your wives." My guess is that virtually every man who sues his wife for divorce has broken that negative command. He has become bitter at his wife. Many wives, especially some husbands, but especially wives, have broken the negative command I read a while ago in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 5, where it says, "To defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time." That also produces many unhappy marriages and much divorce in our day. Almost any time we hear of a teenage rebel, we know we probably have one or both parents who have broken the negative command in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, which is also repeated in Colossians, "And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath." That's the negative command. Key negative command to husbands. Key negative command to wives. Key negative command to parents. And one key negative command that I've been able to find in relation to getting to the marriage altar. And many marriages are damaged or destroyed before they are ever even well established because one or both parties have violated 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 6. I submit to you that I believe the reason, I underline the reason, the divorce rate among Christians is higher than the divorce rate among atheists, and it is, sadly, is because we are carelessly and flippantly breaking God's negative command in this area, and there are severe consequences for breaking the negative commands. But there is a second reason, perhaps even bigger, why I refer to the magnitude of this sin of defrauding in relationships, and that is because I cannot find, I have talked to other preachers, none of them have been able to tell me. You might tell me later, I would love to hear it. No other sin I have been able to find in the entire Word of God promises that God will carry out vengeance on His own children who do this, except this sin right here. That no man go beyond and defraud, that no person go beyond and defraud his brother, means brother or sister in any matter. And what is the matter he's talking about? He's talking about the matter of getting to the marriage altar, because that the Lord is also the avenger of all such. As we have also forewarned you and testified. I seem always to think here of how many of our Bible colleges actually promote the boyfriend-girlfriend game, and how many of those young men have then experienced, if this verse is true, and it is true, then those young men have experienced the vengeance of God Himself upon them for defrauding, and they have no idea that it's even happening. They're wondering what is going on. The boyfriend-girlfriend game is not the small, innocent, cute little thing that people make it out to be. This is bigger than huge in God's sight. God Himself says, I avenge this for my own children. I thought, well, maybe that word avenge you, maybe it's not that strong. Then I looked it up and I found out, you will be hard-pressed to find any word in the Bible any stronger than this word. The Greek word for avenger shows up as the word vengeance in Jude chapter 1, verse 7, where it says, even as Sodom and Gomorrah, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Same Greek root word. God avenges the sin of defrauding. And in Jude 1:7, the Greek root word is Sodom and Gomorrah suffered the vengeance of eternal fire from God for what they did. The word is translated punished in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 9, where it says, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of His power. And another form of that Greek root word is translated vengeance in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 8, where it says, listen to this, in flaming fire taking vengeance on them that know not God. Those are very powerful words, and the same Greek root word is used right here, that God avenges those who defraud in this area. I'm not sure I have ever read any other passage in the Bible that promises such strong judgment from God on a Christian for breaking one of God's commands. There is, first of all, the meaning of defrauding. Secondly, the magnitude of the sin of defrauding. And then thirdly, very important here, the message that arises out of God's command against defrauding. What is the message here anyway? If we're to avoid the enormous consequences of defrauding, then it's imperative that we see clearly how God, our Creator, views the human life He created and what His plan and purpose is for each phase of life. We believe God created everything, don't we? We believe that God created man. We believe that He created woman. We believe that He created all of the earth and sea and land. We believe He created all of the animals. But folks, that's not all that God created. God also did not just simply create man. He created marriage itself. He created this relationship between a man and a woman. He had a plan for that. He has a plan for how, a very clear plan for how that relationship is to be established. Now, I'm talking about how we need to look at how God views the human life that He created. God set up human life, watch my hands here, so that it moves through three distinct phases of life. The first phase is the foundational phase for phase 2 and 3. If you mess up phase 1, you'll probably have trouble with phase 2 and also with phase 3. Then phases 1 and 2 form the foundation for phase 3. And if you mess up phase 1 and phase 2, you're probably going to have trouble with phase 3. The first phase of human life is being single. Everybody I know of starts out being single. I've never seen a baby that was married, and neither have you. The first phase, twice in the Scriptures, such a person is called not betrothed. The purpose of single life, according to 1 Corinthians 7, verse 32, is to care for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. So this single person, male or female, is to focus on how they can fall in love with the things of God and please God. What pleases God? Loving God and loving everybody else as you love yourself. That's not really very complicated, you know it? What pleases God? Serving God and serving others. Spreading the gospel by your lips and your life. You want to see the example of a single person in the Bible? See Jesus as a single young man with a mature sense of responsibility, purpose, and destiny when he stood in the temple before those elders and doctors at age 12. See his obedience and respectfulness. See his burning hunger to understand truth and wisdom, and you'll see the perfect picture of what a single person should be. Some people were meant by God to be single all their lives so that they may focus totally on serving God. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. For single people who are to be married, the second phase of life is not marriage. It is not single life, then married life. The second phase of marriage, as God sees human life, is betrothal or espousal. Some form of the word betrothed occurs 12 times in the Bible and is consistent in its meaning of a relationship established before marriage. The word espouse occurs 7 times in the Bible, with 4 of them in the New Testament. Now I'm going to shock you here. I was totally shocked at what I found here. Those two words, betrothed and espouse, occur 19 times in the Bible, which is more often than the word marriage occurs. I don't know whether that shocked you. That shocks me big time. The word marriage occurs 18 times in the Bible, and the word betrothed or espouse occurs 19 times. Now, if you put together all the forms of the word marry, married, or marriage, they occur 70 times versus 19 times, but I am still astounded at that because the betrothal period of life is one little tiny section out of human life. It may be a year, it may be less than a year, it may be a few weeks or a few months. You've got single life down here for several years, and then you've got a little short slice out of human life. Maybe one, if a man lives 70 years, you've got 1/70th of his life. And yet God says, not 1/70th as many times, He says, here is 19 times for betrothal and espousal versus 70 times for married or marriage. And here is this, and marriage is going to be 40 or 50 times the length of betrothal. Now, let me ask you a question. How significant would it be if we took marriage out of the Bible? Very significant. In fact, what is happening in our day with, quote, homosexual marriage, it's not really happening, they're not really married, because that's not the way God set up human life, so it can't be done that way. So, how significant would it be, though? We know about marriage. We believe the things we believe about a man and a woman and how they're to live together till death do them part, how the husband's to love his wife, how the wife is to reverence her husband, how the husband is supposed to lead his wife with a servant leadership, how the wife is supposed to submit and follow her husband. Why do we know those things? We wouldn't know those things if we didn't have this wonderful, blessed, complete book. So how significant would it be if we took marriage out of the Bible? How significant is it that most Christians have, at least in their minds and hearts, taken betrothal out of the Bible? It's out. We don't talk about it. We don't preach about it. We don't understand it. We don't comprehend it. Preachers leave it out of their preaching. What if we never preached on marriage? What if we never talked about marriage? Do you realize it is in some ways more important for a young person to know how to do betrothal than it is for him to know how to do marriage, because betrothal is the second phase of life, not the third phase of life. And if you're going to have the foundation for marriage right, you've got to have single life right, betrothal right, then you've got marriage and you've got a foundation for the marriage that is proper. What is? We talked about the purpose of the single phase of life, to care for the things of God, to serve God and so on. What is the purpose for this little slice out of human life, that betrothal phase of life? Well, I already told you one of the purposes. It is the second part of the foundation for the third part, which is marriage. So what happens if you rip that out and do away with it? Then you have done away with part of God's foundation for marriage itself. I'll talk more about that later. But there's another purpose for betrothal. Betrothal or espousal is also a young man's way of portraying as a Christian to the world our relationship right now with Jesus Christ. We are not yet married to Christ. That doesn't take place until the end of the book of Revelation. According to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 2, we are presently espoused to Him with our marriage taking place out in the future. So a key way that God meant for the world to see salvation is by seeing Christians entering into betrothal relationships. And that example then, all by itself, says to the world, wow, this is what salvation is like. How sad when Christian parents and young people do not gladly show the testimony of Christ to the world in this area. When we say no, see, that's the purpose of it. That is it, because right now, biblically speaking, we are espoused, we are betrothed to Christ, and so how do we get to see what that is like? Well, when we see a young man who is unashamedly, gladly betrothed and espoused to a young lady, and we see that that is a secure relationship, and we see that he is winning her love every single day, that he is planning their lives together, then the world looks at, and other Christians can look at that and say, oh, that's how Christ loves the church. He is loving them. We are in a secure relationship with Him. He's planning for us a home in heaven one of these days. And so if we leave this out of life, we do away with the key testimony and picture to the world of what the Lord wanted us to picture. There's a third key purpose for the betrothed. This little tiny sliver of life between single life and married life, this betrothal phase, a key purpose of the betrothal phase of life is so that the young man and young lady can fall in love in a safe, secure relationship before they get married. The Bible declares this very plainly. Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 2 talks about the love of thine espousals. The only phase of life planned by God for romance and courtship, which are not really biblical words, I don't really have a problem with them, but they're not really biblical words. The biblical word is love. The only phase of life planned by God for being in love, for romance and courtship to take root and grow all the way then past the betrothal period into marriage and continue. The only place for that is in the betrothal period of life. Which means this: to court without a commitment, to court in any form, to be showing attention to somebody, to court, to be romancing in any way without commitment, is like saying that you can have a proper relationship with God without being saved. That's what it's saying to the world. When betrothal is pictured here and they are growing their love for one another, that says to the world, that's the way Christ and the church are. But when a young man bypasses that and says, I'm just going to like this young lady, I'm just going to court her, And there's not a secure relationship here, then it's like having a relationship with God without being saved. You cannot have a proper relationship with God without being saved. Salvation and betrothal biblically are mirror images of each other. That's what God meant for it to be. I talked to a young lady in her early 20s. She told me how she had been in a, quote, courtship. That's exactly what she called it, with a young man, and she was shocked and hurt deeply when he broke things off. She broke down and cried for hours and was broken and hurt for days, and her dad and mom were trying to console her. That young man defrauded her. And then she said this to me, and I wrote it down. Pastor Davis, I assumed that the courtship would definitely lead to marriage. See, that's the way God planned it. The courtship, the love, the romance, or in that little sliver of life called betrothal, it's a secure relationship leading to marriage. She said, I assumed that the courtship would definitely lead to marriage, but for him, I guess the courtship was just to find out if he thought I was the right one. Where there is any type of courtship, without the commitment, there is almost always defrauding. That same young lady was in a new courtship, which we believe was a true courtship that was understood to mean they were truly serious about getting married. In fact, the date for marriage had definitely already been set. Remember that the only phase of life planned by God for romance and courtship to take root is in the betrothal period. Now, what if you do it before that? Then the word the Bible uses to describe that is not love, it is lust. That not, verse 5 of 1 Thessalonians 4, you don't do this, not in the lust of concupiscence. Concupiscence is unbridled, out-of-control, self-centered passion that is determined to have it its own way, and this lust is driving this unbridled, out-of-control, self-centered passion. Have you ever noticed that when a teen couple breaks up, that often Within a few days or weeks, they each will have a new boyfriend or girlfriend. Very common in our day. Why? Because you are dealing with self-pleasing lust, not love. And lust is an addictive thing that cries out for more and more lust. Lust can't be satisfied. Love can be satisfied. Lust cannot. And so lust cries out for more and more. It is an addictive thing that cries out for more and more lust to satisfy its self-centered cravings. The boyfriend-girlfriend game creates in young people an addiction that is honestly often as difficult to break as many other wrong addictions. When the boy gets around the girl he likes, it gives him a double high. It gives him an emotional high and a hormonal high that leads him to want more the next time. And more the time after that, and more the time after that. And it is not love, it is unbridled lust. Young people actually get hooked on the emotional and hormonal highs like a drug addict gets hooked on needing more drugs. I remember several years ago, there's family in our church, and some of them are actually here tonight. They were calling me for counsel because a member of their family, not actually a child, but a member of their family was actually in a wrong relationship. And I pointed out to them, I said, you are dealing with unbridled lust, and this young person is actually addicted to this. By the way, parental involvement, however much you want to do, will not stop the problems created by young people liking and lusting after each other. Why? Because biblical patterns, biblical phases, biblical principles, and biblical commands are directly being violated by the actions of those who do it. You can involve parents all you want to. It will not stop the damage. If you defraud with parents' permission, if you defraud without parents' permission, it's totally immaterial. The defrauding brings the avenging hand of God. What should be said to young people not ready for betrothal or marriage who are liking and lusting after each other? The same thing you say to children playing with fire: quit that foolishness before somebody gets hurt. The purpose of the betrothal relationship is for a couple to learn to love each other and give to each other and yield to each other while denying the fleshly desires for physical contact. Now, we had an example of single life when we talked about the Lord Jesus at age 12. What is our example for betrothal life? What is our example for this little phase of life that is part of the foundation of life for marriage itself? Joseph and Mary, the earthly stepfather and mother of the Lord Jesus Christ, are our earthly examples of betrothal. They were not toying with each other's emotions. They were truly committed to each other. God the Father, wanting His Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, born in an earthly home where the couple's marriage was established on the foundation, a solid foundation of a biblical espousal or betrothal. And what happens if a marriage is not built on the proper foundation? Mine wasn't. I admit it. As a teen, I liked and lusted after several different girls. I defrauded some of them defrauded me. I believe that was why, right after my wife and I were first married, we had some very serious problems in our marriage. At one point in our life, early marriage, both of us raised in Christian homes, both of us committed to marriage without divorce. But there was a period of time early in our marriage where we were separated for a while, and it really goes back to this problem right here. I was so serious about a girl when I was 12 or 13. We were only separated for a few days, but it was like a nightmare to me. It was like a nightmare to both of us. I was so serious about a girl when I was 12 or 13 years of age that I went to her house several times. I mean, I was really serious. Fortunately, her dad saw what was going on and cut it off. The reason my wife and I have a good marriage today is because by God's grace, we found those areas of the foundation that were filled with lust and error in single life, in the absence of betrothal. We found the areas of the foundation that were filled with lust and error and filled them instead with love and truth. But doesn't it make much more sense for you and your family to build right foundations now for the future? Would you remember something else? When I was a young man, we didn't know the truths I'm preaching to you now. I did what I did ignorantly. It was what most Christians did. And honestly, some people looked at my wife and I's relationship and thought it was pretty good. They thought it was great. And I guess in comparison to the way the rest of the world did it, it was. But it was by far not what it should have been. And we will both gladly admit to that, or sadly admit to that. But you have the truth. The consequences will be worse for you if you despise the truth. He said, "He therefore that despiseth not man." Here's what you'll tend to do. You'll tend to say, "The man who preaches that, the man who teaches that, we don't like what he says, and we don't like him because he says it. He might be a nice guy in some other ways, but we..." No. God put this in here because God knew we were going to run into this sometime in the future. And when you despise this, you're not despising the man who preaches it. You are despising God, who is giving you right now the testimony and the witness of His Holy Spirit in your spirit, saying, "You know what? That's true. You have the truth. And the blessings will be greater for you if you obey the truth." Now, remember the three phases of life designed by God and declared by God in His Word? Single or not betrothed, betrothed, then married. Now, what happens if you say, "I despise that second phase. I reject it. I will not have that in my life. Rip it out." Notice what happens. Look at churches all around us. Look at society all around us. What happens? Because we have ripped this out. When we rip it out, we don't know what to do with what is supposed to go in that phase of life. Love, the love of a man and his espoused, that's where it goes. And when we rip it out, we don't know where to put it. Where do we put this love? Where do we put this courtship? Where do we put this romance? I read an article recently that told how many 7-year-olds are in romances. I heard a news report this week about how many 11 to 16-year-olds have already lost their purity. So what are we having? Love was designed for this betrothal stage. But we don't know where to put it now because we've ripped that out. We've done away with that. So where does it go? Well, maybe it goes with a 7-year-old. And so we laugh and say, "Look, that's so cute. Oh, isn't that cute? Look at him." I have a picture from a newspaper. I didn't bring it up here. On Valentine's Day a few years ago, full color picture from a newspaper in this area, front page section, where it shows a 6-year-old hugging another 6-year-old in her public school class at Valentine's Day. And they were talking about how cute this was. Maybe it belongs with a 15-year-old. After all, they're getting pretty old, and after all, their bodies have already begun developing, and maybe it belongs to a 20-year-old. But you know what happens? It doesn't seem to work with any of them. And parental supervision won't make it work either. And since this is all right, since this love and courtship And it's not kept within betrothal here, then how do we know to even keep it in marriage? If it's all right to have it in this single life down here where you're just lusting after each other and courting and dating and all of this, then maybe it's all right to have it after you're married. Let me show you what we're trying to do. See this little toy here? See these? How many of y'all ever played with one of these? Even the children and the adults here enjoy playing with these things. Now watch what happens. You take that round one and it goes where? Right there. And did you know that is the way love fits perfectly in betrothal? Well, you know what? But we're doing away with that. We don't like that. We don't like that phase of human life. We don't like the fact that God put that phase of human life in human life. So let's get rid of that phase of human life and let's get that love back out of there. We're going to make it fit where we want it to fit. And you know what's going to happen? I can indeed make it fit. I can force that and make it fit. And you know what's going to happen when I do? The love is going to be destroyed. It is no longer love. It is lust. Yes, you can make it fit somewhere that God didn't mean for it to fit. But when you do, you pervert it. And it is no longer what God meant for it to be. Whatever you do instead of betrothal will mess up both single life and married life because you cannot do away with any phase of life God created and meant to be here. The thing most likely to go in its place is going to be lust and defrauding, and the consequences for lust and defrauding will come with what you do as well. There is the meaning of defrauding, the magnitude of the sin of defrauding. The message that arises out of this is that you've got to have these three phases of life. Now, wait a minute. What is God's method to stop the defrauding? Surely God has a way to stop this. How often have I talked to parents for many years now who have felt hopeless? How many times have I heard parents of teens who were liking / lusting after each other say things like this? How can you stop it? I'm going to answer that in just a moment, but let me first point out to you that it is critically important that young people themselves learn how to stop it, because if they don't know how to stop it before betrothal and marriage, how are they going to stop it if it comes on them after marriage? Remember the meaning of defrauding. The primary way defrauding takes place is when a young man or a man who is already married or who is not ready for marriage shows special attention to someone who is not his wife now or who will not be his wife or who is not ready to be married. Defrauding happens when you pay special attention to the wrong person or at the wrong time of life. You can defraud somebody after you're married. An evangelist who was visiting in our church, he and I were sitting down talking. He was telling me of a church he had previously been in. This is just recently. Where the 28 to 30-year-old secretary in the office and the 28 to 30-year-old youth pastor were continually flirting with each other. His office and her office were right next to each other. Both were married to other people. And the evangelist said to me, if they don't do something, they're going to have big problems in that church. Did he tell me the truth? Yes, he did. And you know, some people would have said, well, there's nothing you can do about that. Well, there better be something we can do about that. Why? Because they have what is biblically called an inordinate affection toward each other. You see, 1 Thessalonians 5:4, that every one of you should know how to possess his vessel in sanctification and honor, not in the lust That same Greek word for lust is translated inordinate affection in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, where Paul said, mortify. We get our word mortician from that. He deals with death. Mortify, put to death inordinate affections. How do you put to death an inordinate affection? Well, it's really rather simple. You either stab it or you starve it. You either stab it or you starve it. Now, I'm not done, but you remember the story I began with, how the pastor sitting in his office, the lady looked at him and said, Pastor, I'm in love with you and just needed to let you know. He said, what'd you say? And again, she said, Pastor, I'm in love with you. Oh, you love me. He said, Kim, you wait right here. I'll be right back. The pastor went out of the office. His wife, it was after a revival service. Folks were still milling around. The pastor went out of the office, found his wife out in the auditorium, said, Honey, I need you to come to my office right away. You're not going to believe this one, he said. He and his wife came back in his office and both of them took a seat. He looked at Kim and said, Kim, I need you to tell my wife what you just told me. She said, Pastor, I can't do that. Yes, you can. Go ahead. Just tell my wife what you just told me. Pastor, I can't. Finally, Kim looked at the pastor's wife and said, I told Pastor that I love him. And the pastor said, I listened to the message this afternoon where he told this story. He said, now folks, you need to understand, I believe in strong pastoral leadership. So I looked at those two ladies and I said, I don't feel that this is something for me to deal with. I'm going to leave and go shake some more hands and let you two ladies work this out. And he left. Do you need to guess whether or not they got it worked out? You know what that pastor did? He stabbed that inordinate affection. I promise you, when that lady walked out of that office, that inordinate affection was dead. She said, she was saying to herself, preacher friend who told me that story a few weeks ago, he told his wife that story. His wife looked at him and said, if that had been you and you walked out of that room, I would have beaten her to a pulp. Now, I don't think she really would have, but I'm telling you something. Are you getting this? It is possible to stab to death an inordinate affection. I was with a pastor in another state out east several months ago, and he said, Brother Davis, I got to meet with a fella after church. He said, I'm going to be a little later. He said, it won't take me long. He said, 5 or 10 minutes. It actually took him 10 or 15 minutes. Finally, he came out. He said, well, we can go now. And then he started telling me what he was doing meeting with that man. This married man with 3 children had been saying inappropriate things to other married ladies in his church. A few weeks earlier, a husband and wife had come and told the pastor about it. The pastor had the husband go to the man and confront the man and ask him not to do it. But since then, that man had gone and talked to another lady and said to her these words, quote, you are really beautiful on the inside and the outside. Don't tell anybody I said this to you. I want to ask you a question. Does anybody besides me have any business making a statement like that to my wife? No. Should anybody else, Brother McCann, be making a statement like that to your wife? Brother Cotton, should anybody else be making a statement like that to anybody but your wife? No, he crossed the line. His was an inordinate affection, and the pastor took him into office and stabbed his inordinate affection. The pastor confronted him, and the man said, "Oh, I didn't mean it that way." And you know, when you see two young people who are in this liking, lusting, inordinate affection thing, there are people who say, "Well, that's no big deal." But it's amazing. Everybody else, all the other young people, seem to know what it is. He said, "Well, I didn't mean it that way." And the pastor told the man to not speak to any lady in the church other than to say hello or goodbye and do nothing more than shake hands. And he said, "Sir, if you want to stay in this church, you're going to do what I tell you." Thank God for a pastor doing what he had to do. So we come to the key question. How do you stop the boyfriend-girlfriend thing? Well, let me ask another question to answer that. How do you stop your child from being run over by a truck? Well, we've all had to teach our children how to keep from being run over. What do? You teach them of the danger. You warn them of the danger. You teach and warn them until they understand it and know it like you understand it and know it. And then when your child decides he's going to go ahead and stand in the middle of the road anyway, you pull him away before he gets hit. And then you start all over again. You teach a child or a teenager continually of the danger of the boyfriend-girlfriend game. It's not enough. The preacher cannot preach on this thing as much as it deserves. The magnitude of this sin deserves godly parents warning their children of this thing every week of their lives, if not every single day of their lives. You remind them regularly of the bad fruit. You remember when I preached the seeds of disintegration planted by the boyfriend-girlfriend philosophy, and I showed all the bad fruit of the wasted years and the ruined reputations and the abortions and the murders and the suicide and on and on and on, the destruction to youth groups, the destruction to churches. I went through all that list. You remember that? You remind your children regularly of the bad fruit, and you watch and listen to sermons repeatedly until the child himself can tell you in his sleep what is wrong with it. Could I tell you something? It is more important. It is every bit as important for your child's future for him to not get run over by this truck as it is for him to not get run over out in that road out yonder. You make sure the truth has made the journey from the head to the heart, because if you don't get this in your heart, it's not going to work anyway. We both know it. And all along the way, from the time the truth is traveling from God's Word to the head and ultimately to the heart, you guard them and protect them until you're pretty sure they've made the truth not your truth, but their truth. And then you release them to see if they have truly learned how to walk across the road by looking both ways and moving carefully. And if you see they're about to get hit by this emotional truck that can damage both of them and someone else at the same time, then you pull them away and you start all over again. Remember that Colossians 3:5 says, "Mortify inordinate affections." It means put them to death. Now here's what's interesting to me. There are two other passages in the New Testament where that Greek word for mortify occurs. Romans 4:19 and Hebrews 11:12. And in both of them, it is referring to Abraham, whose body was as good as dead when God gave him a son, Isaac. It was referring, mortify is not referring just to a sudden death, but primarily to a slow death process. You may not always be able to stab an inordinate affection and it die a quick death. You may have to starve an inordinate affection to death. You see, when you feed your flesh, it grows. When you starve the flesh, it dies. When you feed inordinate affections with conversation and listening and attention and special looks or even gifts or touches, that inordinate affection will grow. It doesn't matter whether you're single or married. Actually, it doesn't matter whether you're single, betrothed, or married. It's going to grow. That inordinate affection And it's possible even for somebody in a betrothal to have an inordinate affection to somebody else, you see? Any phase of life here, you can have an inordinate affection. And if you feed it, that inordinate affection will grow until it becomes the biggest thing, can easily become the biggest thing in your life, and you will fight to defend it and die to defend it, even if it's wrong. You starve an inordinate affection by doing the very opposite. You stop the conversations. You stop the emails, the texting, the calls, the letters. You stop giving attention to that other person. You get rid of their pictures. You get rid of their gifts. The picture or gift is a way of connecting with them in their absence. You get rid of all that. You try your best to not see them at all, but if you do see them, you determine that your eyes, the windows of the soul, communicate distance, not closeness. The eyes must say, this is done. This is over. A parent to stay in a good church would probably have to keep their child with them almost every second they are in church. And the question then is, do you love your child enough to do this for them? It may take weeks or months for the inordinate affection to die, but after a while, it will die. But, Pastor, can't guys and girls just be friends? Casual acquaintances, yes. Close friends, no. And where there has been an inordinate affection, they probably will not be able to be even casual friends for years, if ever. The way to understand this is to think of it in relation to married adults. Any married man in this church should be able to speak to any married lady in this church and discuss many different things. They could both be in the choir. They could be talking about some music. They could be talking about something in the bulletin. They could be talking about all kinds of things. But the day a married man and any lady but his wife start meeting and talking just to be enjoying each other's company, there is an inordinate affection. And that needs to be starved to death, and they can probably never even be casual friends in the future. And the same applies to two single young people. I said that the word mortify there means to die a slow but sure death. The Greek word could also mean the absence of the ability to regenerate without the help of God, because that's what Abraham had. His body was dead, except God enabled him to father a son. In other words, inordinate affections must die so completely that there's no longer even the expectation of a possible relationship, I chandra, in the future. Could I be honest with you? I had a bunch of inordinate affections as a teenager. Those inordinate affections are long ago dead now. Friends toward all, intentions toward none. It seems parents sometimes struggle to do what they need to do to stop an inordinate affection between a young man and a young lady. So let me ask this. Would you do what you had to do to stop it if it was a homosexual or sodomite inordinate affection between your son and another guy? How about if it was between your daughter and another girl? Because that word inordinate affection, study it, may clearly refer to that type of relationship as well. I am thinking right now, I could give you their names, I would not, of at least two teenagers who were in this church in years past who developed inordinate boyfriend-girlfriend affections, were not stopped by their parents or by themselves, and went on to eventually develop other more perverted relationships as adults. To say it is not possible to stop an inordinate affection between two people is to say the same thing the world is saying right now about homosexual relationships. I read a sickening news report recently about a, quote, pastor who was separating from his wife and children in order to live with his, quote, boyfriend. And the pastor, quote, planned to continue as a pastor. Oh, that is sick. Amen. We need to distance ourselves as far as possible from such sick, perverted thinking. God's method to stop defrauding is to put inordinate affections to death. You follow me here? The meaning of defrauding, stirring up wrong desires by paying special attention to the wrong person or at the wrong time. The magnitude of the sin of defrauding. It is the only negative command in relation to getting to the marriage altar. The only sin where God carries out vengeance on His own children that I've found who do it. The message that arises out of this command is we must understand the three phases of human life, single, betrothed, and married life, and understand God's purposes for each of them, and then God's method to stop defrauding is to put inordinate affections to death and then to establish betrothals not with courting but with questions. Not with courting but with questions. You ever notice what happens? Even if a man and a woman are truly old enough to be married and they pair off and they start courting and they're not in a secure relationship, they're not engaged, they're not betrothed, people start saying, what's going on there? And I want to tell you something. You can't blame the people for that, because if you think like God thinks, that is confusing. You establish betrothals not with courting. Courting takes place in betrothal, not before. You establish it with question. The question always rises, how do we get to know somebody? Well, the best thing is not by dating or courting. That often produces defrauding. Let families get to know each other while watching to make sure their children are guarding their hearts. When a man who is ready to be married, remember Matthew 19:5 says, therefore shall a man leave father and mother and cleave to his wife. Several times here I've said a young man. The truth is, this must be a man to enter betrothal and marriage. I'm not even touching the age issue. It's got to be a man and a woman. There have been down in history, there have been people of all sorts of ages, from the teenage years up, who were men and women. When a man who is ready to be married sees a lady who is ready to be married, and she obviously has the character to be a good wife, then he and his father should talk about this and pray about this. Then they should talk to their pastor, because God almost always gives a father and a pastor insights he doesn't give to anyone else. If God gives direction further, they may talk to the lady's father. The father may say, no, you're a fine young man, I just don't feel like you're God's choice. Or he may say, if you're still interested a year from now, you could come back. I see some things in my daughter, I don't think she's ready for marriage yet. Or he may say, you know, a year or two from now, you could come back if you're still interested. I feel like, as we've talked a little bit, I feel like you need to be better established in order to take care of a family, and we're not ready for that. Or he may say something else. Now, no young man knows 100% for sure until the father and daughter both say yes. Something a father should not do at this point is go and ask his daughter and then go back to the young man and say, my daughter said she isn't interested, because that is rejection. If the father senses this might be of God, then he and his wife should have a list of questions prepared ahead of time to ask the young man. You remember how Jesus discerned where his disciples were in their maturity by asking them questions. That's what he did. Matthew 16:13, whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? Who do you say that I am? Luke 24:26, Jesus on the road to Emmaus with those other two disciples. But ought not Christ to have suffered these things? He is checking them out. Here are some of the questions we used with two of our son-in-laws. We're going to post these on our website at some time. But listen to these questions that we sat down and asked to our son-in-laws before they were married. All my girls are married now. Describe your salvation, baptism, and church background. Tell me some truth God has shown you from His Word in the last week. What is the most significant answer to prayer you've ever had? I really think the answer to that question, when I heard it, was very significant in the last betrothal that we had. How do you feel about financial debt? Do you have debts? Give us the name of someone not related to you who has seen you keep your word under difficult circumstances. What are a husband's responsibilities in marriage? What do you feel are a wife's responsibilities in marriage? Should a wife work outside the home? What is your view of having children? I'm not saying which way they go there. I'm just saying these are good questions. What's your view of having children? Tell us when, why, and how you were disciplined as a child. How does your family celebrate holidays or birthdays? Do you consider yourself to be sentimental? How? Do you clean up after yourself? What if your daughter is a neat freak and he is a sloppy slob? Huh? Do you clean up after yourself? She could still fall in love with him, and it might be something that, man, I don't know what I can deal with or not. Do you mind helping with housework and children? Do you cook? Have you lived on a budget? Do you have a savings account? How thrifty are you? How recent is your desire to marriage? The ultimate question you must get to at some point is, why do you feel my daughter is God's choice, or maybe God's choice for your life's mate? Why do you feel that way? What are your standards on dress, music, tithing, missions, lots of other things? How actively involved are you in the church? How about your parents? How involved will you want your wife to be after marriage? Has there been an anger problem in your home? How important are you diligent? How many hours a week do you or have you work? How attentive are you to your mother? Have you been opening your mother and your sister's car doors? Tell us of a time when somebody did you wrong and how you went about forgiving them. How important are the words, till death do you part? Do you believe there is any possibility of divorce after marriage? How are you now financially prepared for marriage? Describe relationships with your father, your mother, your siblings, your boss, your pastor. Has there ever been a time when you had to stand alone and it cost you something? What do you feel like God wants you to do with your life? What are your eating habits? What are your sleeping habits? Are you always punctual, always late, or something in between? What was it like growing up? We're not looking for perfection. We're looking for direction, folks. What was it like growing up in your family? What did you like, dislike? Tell us about your siblings. Did you have a favorite? Why did you have it? What were your parents like? How did they influence you? Whom do you most resemble? What good character qualities have you inherited? What traumatic events have occurred? How did they affect you? How did you work through this whole thing? Actually, we've got 2 pages full here. I only read half of them, and actually we have more than that. After you have asked these questions, then you'll be ready to move to the next stage if you feel like this. I remember when we did the night we did this with Glenn Gill several months ago. I came home after spending, and it was not, I don't think it was a grilling. We loved him. We told him when we started, we love you. We're going to love you when we walk away from here. We're not expecting you to be perfect. We're just talking about our daughter, and we just want to understand some things. That's all. And we're not perfect. You're not perfect. We don't expect you to be. We just want to ask some questions. The best way to do it is to ask some questions. Now, I came back home after having done that, and I looked at my wife, and I said, honey, I cannot describe to you how I feel right now. I remember when my oldest daughter was 16 years of age, and for years I preached a message on Christian dating. And I told my daughters, when you turn 16, I'll take you on your first date, and I'll escort you. And I came home that night, and I looked at my wife, and I said, I don't know what happened tonight, but something's bad wrong here. My spirit is registering a huge negative, and I don't know what's wrong, but something isn't right with this. And after that was when God gave me the passion to research this and study this until I could begin to understand it. And I don't know that I still fully understand it. I don't know that I will in this lifetime. But what I came home that night after talking to Glenn, I looked at my wife and I said, my spirit, I said, we still may need to pray a little while about what we're doing with Glenn, but I want to tell you, honey, what we just did was right. This is not an emotional decision to be made. You don't build a marriage on emotions. You build a marriage on biblical truth and character. I said, this is biblical. This is logical. This is right. I would suggest that after that, the young lady have her own list of questions because it's her life and future that are at stake. I never will forget that night that we took Glenn and Gina. We set them on this side of the restaurant. We went to the other side of the restaurant. And by that point, we've already said, now, Gina, the decision is yours. And she had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages of questions. Could I tell you something? Whatever you think about what I'm talking about right now, it sure beats emotion. At one point that night, I walked over, I looked at him, and I said, I want to get a picture of y'all. And I said, you thought my list of questions was something, didn't you? He said, boy, are you ever telling the truth? I won't read them all, just a few. What's your view of marriage? Now, these two young people who are definitely interested in each other at this point, but she had already said to me, Dad, if he's not the one, if he's not God's choice, you know, he's a great guy, but if he's not God's choice, what is your view of marriage? Do you consider yourself a giver or a taker? How would your family and friends describe you as a giver or a taker? What is your view of a father, a husband, a wife, a mother, a son or daughter? What part does each of them play? What are their roles in life? What is your stand on divorce? Why do you feel like I'm the one for you? What a question, huh? Are there any Bible verses that helped you confirm this decision? How long have you prayed about this? What counselors did you ask about it? Folks, this is for life. This is not an emotional decision. This is a biblical and spiritual decision. What counselors did you ask about this? Were there any hesitations on their part? What were their hesitations? And then questions about children and discipline and personal things and birthdays and games and entertainment and faith and taking care of a house and holidays and getting counsel and communication and lots of things here. Questions. Establish betrothals, not with courting, but with questions. That's the way biblically Jesus discerned where His disciples were. That is the best way. Besides just seeing a family, seeing somebody, looking at them, there is not any such thing as perfection in this process. There never has been. There never will be. We are fallible people, but we must recognize that God made us. God made human life. He made three phases of life. Single life, a little sliver of life called betrothal, and married life. And if we want marriages, if we want to stop this divorce train that's running through our churches and running rampant through our country, if we want to stop it, we're going to have to find out some way to get these phases of life like God wants them to be. Otherwise, this married couple, after they get married, are going to be going back trying to pick out the damage, the error, the destruction from this. In closing, I want to make an observation and a plea. When I came here as your pastor in 1975, this was what I would call a smoking church. The first time I got out of a car on Sunday morning, I walked past several men standing outside the church, all taking a... I'm not condemning anybody. I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm just telling the facts like it was. When I preached against smoking, people got upset. There are people who have died with lung cancer who said to me, it is none of your business whether I smoke or not. I had a man that came to me, he just died in the last few months, who left our church in 1978. He came back to our church a few times, but 25 years after the fact, several years ago now, this man came to me and said, Brother Davis, I need to talk to you. He said, I need to apologize to you for leaving the church back yonder. I was wrong. I didn't like you preaching. And I was wrong. And the destruction of my family has come because of it. Will you forgive me? And I said,
Brother, I forgave you long ago. I love you. Just come on back to church.
During 1981 to 1984, we had a building program here. And Brother Kaufman was the main contractor, and he told all the guys who came and worked on the building, this is a holy place. We don't want any smoke in here. And the guys who had the habit of smoking had to go in. I don't know that I would have even done it, but Brother Kaufman did it. I just let him. If he'd get by with it, it's all right with me. They had to go to their car to smoke. Have you noticed that this property is almost basically a smoke-free zone now? Have you noticed that? Occasionally somebody will come in, they'll have the habit, and in between Sunday school and church, they'll slip outside, and that's all right. We love them, and we don't think anything. Occasionally you'll walk outside and see somebody out yonder, we don't think anything about it ever. But you know what? Being a smoke-free zone, we're all better off for it. It says to our young people, that's not a healthy... Even I know there are people in our church right now who have the habit of smoking. Some people here who don't even know that you know, who don't even know that I know you have the habit of smoking. I know about it. I don't condemn you. I recognize at this point it's a major weakness. You've tried to get victory over it. But at least it's not out in public. What is public creates an atmosphere about what is acceptable. 2 weeks ago, I got off the plane in Las Vegas, Nevada. And as I got off the plane, massive, giant screens, as big as that screen right there, greeted us with people with almost no clothes on. We had to walk past, as going through the airport terminal, we had to walk past slot machines. My grandson was with me, and to get to the restaurant, we had to walk through a huge room full of slot machines and other gambling devices. And you know what? I've never had to do that here in Illinois. We're better off for it. Did you know that? Ezekiel chapter 24, verse 7. The prophet Ezekiel talked about the sin of the people, and he referred to the blood on the top of the rock. He said, you're not even ashamed of this. You put it out on the top of the rock where everybody can see it, and God said he was not happy with it. As I close, I just want to beg and plead with parents and young people here tonight. How much more damage and destruction do we have to see to human lives before we realize that the boyfriend-girlfriend game is not of God? And it is destroying far more lives and futures and homes and families than cigarettes ever thought about destroying. You say, but somebody's going to come in. Well, folks come in from outside. We love them. Everybody's welcome here. We've had guys and girls come in here and they hug right in the... I mean, they're not married and they hug right in the middle of the church service. And I've seen them sit... I've seen guys sit there and put his hands over on... He's not even married and he's doing this kind of stuff. I know that's going to happen. I'm talking about God's people saying publicly, let's just try to do things God's way. Because if we don't, what's going to happen is... when it becomes acceptable for any older young people to do it, then it passes down and it's acceptable for any young people of any age to do it. And it won't be long till we'll be paying all over again all the devastating consequences. Would you join me in prayer? This is my appeal. I'm done. Would you join me in prayer that God would make our church a safe, boyfriend, girlfriend, free zone where young people try their best. Somebody might fail sometime, but they're trying their best to keep their hearts for one other person until they can give their heart away in that betrothal relationship. And I'm telling you, that's beautiful when it happens. It's wonderful when it happens. Nothing improper about that. No question about that. It's wonderful. And then you see him stand at the marriage altar, and it's so much better, folks.
if we do things God's way. Would you bow with me, please?